Welcome back to AppFabric TV. I'm your host, Ron Jacobs, joined today by Jeff Richter. Welcome, Jeff.
Hi. Nice to be here.
You know, so Jeff, we've been on this kick about Threads. Yes. In the last two episodes, I was talking with Dustin from our performance team. We were troubleshooting these problems with Threads and threading. And I was remembering, I actually took, you teach a class about advanced threading and all this. It was a fantastic class. Loved it.
Thank you.
And so I was thinking, wouldn't it be cool? In fact, you and I did, you did one of my very first podcasts many years ago about threading. It was very popular.
Long time ago.
Yeah, so you know, Jeff, I think there's profound misunderstanding about threads and threading, and, you know, like, people are like, hey, threads, cool, we can do all kinds of stuff at once, the more the merrier, let's make lots of threads. So how do you respond to that?
Yeah, so that is a common misconception that a lot of people have, for sure. So the main thing that people need to understand is that threads are not free. They have a lot of expense associated with them.
Mm-hmm.
Just to enumerate just some of the things, whenever you create a thread, there's a user mode stack, which in the managed world is 1 megabyte in size.
Mm.
So you're allocating at least a meg for each thread. There's also a kernel mode stack, though, that's 12K or 24K, depending on if you're on a 32-bit or 64-bit system.
Mm-hmm.
There's a thread kernel object that's another couple kilobytes where the system keeps track of this thread and its state. There's a user mode thread environment block that's another 4K or 8K, depending on the system that you're running on. And then in the managed world, there's a managed thread object that's on top of all of that.
Mm.
So you got to say to yourself, whenever you create a thread, that there's a megabyte and really more than that for each thread that you are creating. So there's a substantial overhead.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing that people need to know is that the CPU, each core, can only run one thread at a time. So if you have 10 threads on a single processor machine, what Windows does is it schedules only one thread to that core, and then it has to context switch between all those different threads. So they're not all running at the same time.
Mm.
So really, you've allocated all this additional resources, and then you're not using 9 out of 10 of them at any given time.
Mm-hmm.
And then the context switch for Windows does to switch from one thread to another is additional overhead that also hurts performance even more. And that's the part that has not been well documented over the years, and a lot of people don't really understand to get an appreciation for this overhead can really hurt their application substantially.
Yeah, I remember in the class you talked about how one of the bad designs that people often use is they say, like, oh, I have a thread for this kind of job and another thread for this kind of job. So we make, like, all these threads for different sorts of jobs we want to do. And I just took away from that it's probably a bad idea for me to ever create a new thread. I mean, I probably shouldn't be creating threads in my app.
I completely agree. So it is common for people to have this mindset of, this is my thread that does this client's request. This is the thread that does, I don't know, spell checking. This is the thread that does grammar checking.
Uh-huh.
And when people put a label on a thread like that, then they are subconsciously said to themselves that that thread can't be used for anything but that.
Right.
And so if you're not doing spell checking or grammar checking all the time, then the thread is just sitting there idle in the system where it's wasted all these resources, but it's not been doing anything valuable for you.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Now, here on AppFabric TV, of course, we're writing a lot of server-side apps, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think sometimes people assume that there's some kind of magic that goes on, that ASP.NET or WCF or somebody is just doing some wonderful magic. That suddenly my code wakes up and then I can just do whatever I want because that's magic. How does this actually work?
Well, so let me walk you through these slides. I have some animated slides where
mm-hmm.
I can talk about the way most people implement a service today.
Okay.
And it doesn't scale very well.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, before I do this, I ran another program that I wrote, and I'd like to talk about the results of this.
Oh, sure. Okay.
I wrote a program that all it does is in an infinite loop, just create a thread, create a thread, create a thread, create a thread. And each time I create a thread, right after I create it, I ask Windows, how many private bytes is my program using?
Okay.
It takes a few minutes for this thing to run, so I ran it before we started recording.
Yeah.
But as you can see, when I got up to thread 1,325, that's what this number shows, I now had 1,397 megabytes of private bytes in my application.
Wow.
And as I added another thread, it went up by another megabyte, and another thread went up for another megabyte, and another thread actually went up by 2 megabytes, and that's because of just rounding error, because
right.
it really is more than 1 megabyte per thread. thread. And that's all this program was doing, was just creating threads and reporting the number of private bytes.
Yeah.
Eventually, the program throws an exception, by the way, and I actually have it stopped here in the debugger. So you can see that eventually it did stop, with it, and it caught an out-of-memory exception. Now, this was a 32-bit process I ran it in. A 32-bit process has 2 gigabytes of usable memory, and it, we ended up exhausting it all just from creating all the threads, and I got an out-of-memory exception. So this, a common question that a lot of people ask me is, how many threads can I create in a process? And we can see from this that the answer to that number is 1,361.
Right.
but what really limits the number of threads is that we ran out of memory.
And that was not even doing anything else with the thread, right?
That's
just a simple program.
Right. Yeah. And in fact, my program is out of memory now. So if I wanted to, let's say, load a document in or process some XML document, I have no memory left over to load any of that and to do anything with it at all. Another thing to note, just as a side note, is that the more threads you have, the more that affects the garbage collector in a bad way.
Right.
When a GC kicks in, then the garbage collector, first thing it does is suspend all the threads in the process. So here it would have to suspend 1,361 threads.
Well, that'll take a while.
Yeah, it does. Then you have to walk up a bunch of thread stacks to find all the routes. Then it has to fix up the routes. Then it has to resume all those threads. And so the more threads you have can have a really adverse effect on the garbage collector. So anyway, that's shows you that having all of those threads occupies a lot of memory.
Right.
And so if you had, let's say, a server-side application, to get back to your question, where you had one thread per client request, which is a very common, probably the most common architecture for a server app, that means that my app couldn't process more than 1,360 concurrent clients.
Right.
Before it would throw an out-of-memory exception, and then my server would actually crash, and then stop processing all of them, and then we'd have to restart the service in order to start handling them again.
Right.
So clearly, that's not scalable.
Okay.
So now let's go and take a look at that architecture a little bit more closely with these animated slides. What I show here is a bunch of clients that are making requests using some browser, let's say Internet Explorer, into some server. This server could be an ASP.NET website or MVC, or it might be WCF. It doesn't really matter what kind of server it is, because the lessons learned are apply to all. And then this server is going to make a request to yet another server, perhaps SQL Server, some database. So a client comes and makes a request in. Now, clients, the request will come into the thread pool for ASP.NET or WCF. That's the CLR thread pool. The thread pool will then create a thread on behalf of that client request. That client request, then if it talks to some other server, performs some other I.O., it really sends a I.O. request packet down to the network device driver, since it's communicating over the network to this server over here. And our thread will now block if it does this synchronously, which again is what most people do. So then, since that thread is now blocked, waiting for SQL to reply, if another client sends a request in, then the thread pool has to create a new thread because its thread it already has is just busy, stuck. So it creates a second thread, which then maybe makes another request down, and then that thread blocks. And if a third client makes a request, then the thread pool creates yet another thread, which then blocks. And really what this server spends most of its time doing is creating threads so that they can stop running. And that does not scale very well at all. You're allocating all of these resources. And again, after we had 1,360 some of these, then we would get an out-of-memory exception and the program would just crash.
And like I always like to say, a blocked thread is an unhappy thread.
That is correct. Very much true. Very much true. I will point out that if this was a 64-bit process, then you could create a lot more threads because you have 8 terabytes of usable address space as opposed to the 2 gigabytes.
Provided you put that much RAM in the system.
Right, there's all of the other caveats, yes, but you'd be able to get, at least increase your scalability, but it's still coming at a very high cost.
Sure.
And it's being done very inefficiently. But the story here actually gets worse, because now let's say that this server down below, it responds with the 3 responses back. That's going to unblock those 3 threads, and they will all start running concurrently. But if we're on a machine that has, let's say, just 2 processors on it, then Windows can't run all 3 of these simultaneously. It can only run 2 at a time on those cores. And so now context switching is introduced to schedule these in a round-robin fashion, the 3 threads amongst the 2 cores, and that context switching has additional performance overhead, making your program run slower.
Right.
And then finally, when all of these are done, all of these threads would eventually return all the way back to the pool and then send the results back to the respective clients. Mm. And now we have a lot of threads that are just sitting in the pool that aren't doing anything until new client requests come in. The thread pool has a policy that when thread sits in there with nothing to do for approximately 2 minutes in time, then they wake themselves up and they kill themselves off, which is a performance hit. But at least you're reclaiming all the resources for the thread when that happens. So there's some good and some bad to that. A better way to architect this code so that it really scales well is to do it this way. We'll have our first client make a request into the server, and that'll get queued up in the thread pool. Then a thread pool thread will wake up and start doing the work. It'll make a request down to whatever our server is here, but now here's the part where it changes. Instead of making that request synchronously, it's better if it does it asynchronously, and then that thread can simply go back to the pool. So then if another client makes a request in, it'll come into the pool. The same thread will wake up and process the second client request, issue another asynchronous request down to the server, and then go back to the pool. And then for the third request, the same thing will happen again. Mm-hmm. You'll notice in this example, there's only one thread that the thread pool has created, but it's handling the workload of all three of those client requests that are coming in. Now, because the I/O requests were made asynchronously to the server down below, when it responds with the results, they get queued up into the thread pool. Mm. So let's say that SQL now responds with the three responses back into the thread pool. The thread pool knows how many CPUs we have. If we're running on a machine with only one CPU, it will use that one thread to go and take the request, the response, process it, and then ultimately send the result back to the browser. Mm-hmm. And then it'll go and do the same for the second, and it'll go and do the same for the third. And in this case, we've had really only one thread on the server that's processed the entire workload. So the amount of memory we have is very, very minute. The thread keeps going back to the pool, so it doesn't build up a deep stack, which is good for improving garbage collection time. And this server scales out beautifully to literally tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of clients' requests all being processed concurrently. Mm. And if we have a machine with multiple processors on it, then the thread pool does know that, and it would, let's say on a quad processor machine, have four threads to processing everything simultaneously as best as it possibly can.
Yeah, so you know, the thing that's interesting about this is that there's this fallacy that says three threads is better than one. But we just demonstrate here that really, no, if it were on a single core box, it would be better to have just one thread.
That's very true.
Yeah, and so I think sometimes people go, how does that work? If I make this async call, let's say, you know, if I'm using the begin-end model, right? So when I go to call SQL Server, I do like begin, and then
query or something.
Yeah, and then I get my async result object, and then, you know, hold on to that, and I have this callback. So How does that work under the covers? Yeah.
So whenever you call a begin method that's performing an I/O operation, like the to the network, the begin method internally creates a data structure for Windows called the I/O request packet. The I/O request packet's maybe a couple hundred bytes or something. It's relatively small, and it includes a bunch of information about the request, like how many bytes you're reading or writing, and to what device you're making this request to. That is then sent down to the Windows operating system kernel, which then takes the I/O request packet and it queues it for the right device driver. Now, if you're doing something synchronously, so you're not calling, let's say, begin read, but you're calling read instead, then the device driver blocks your thread at that point, so your thread's no longer running on any CPU while the hardware is doing the I/O. But if you use the begin method, then after the ERP is queued down to the device driver, then the device driver releases your thread and it lets it return from the begin method. At that point, .NET does create this iasync result object, which is basically this cookie or receipt, if you will, that you have queued up this operation. That does get returned from the begin method, but I usually recommend to people that they ignore that because the CLR is going to hold on to that for you internally. So the one that gets returned from the begin method, you can just throw that away. That simplifies your coding. When the device driver then gets around to doing your I/O request and the result comes back in from the SQL server or the network server, what have you, it will then, the device driver will then queue up that result back to the CLR thread pool from the CLR that issued it. And then a thread pool thread will wake up and will call a callback method that you pass as an argument to the begin method. And now your callback method knows here is the result. So rather than having a thread blocked waiting for the I.O. to complete, the thread pool is told when the I.O. completes, and then you start running in response to that. And that ensures that your threads are never blocking. Yeah. And they will pass back to you the iasync result in that callback. And from that, you can call the end method, which will look inside the iasync result to give you the result that came back. Yeah. So rows from the database or XML from a web service or something like that is what you'll get back. And then you process that.
Yeah, so now it's very interesting when we think about the case where your thread was blocked. Okay, so if we come in here and I do the, you know, we all know that it's probably simpler just to write the synchronous code, and a lot of people just do it because it's simpler. But then, so now my thread is blocked. Then the other request comes in, and the thread pool looks and says, I have one thread, but it's blocked.
Right.
So then it does that expensive operation, creating another thread.
Right.
Yes. Okay. And so, but now let's talk a little bit about the way that the worker processes work with IIS. Okay. Because most people are going to be writing code that lives in a worker process.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about this in the other episodes of Endpoint TV, that there is these thread pools come kind of pre-populated with some number of threads that the CLR uses an algorithm to calculate, like, it's going to have a minimum number, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So then it, when it gets there, there's like this pool's already kind of warmed up with some threads that are ready to go. But the CLR ideally doesn't want to create more of these, right? I mean, ideally, if we're efficient, we should be able to get our work done in those threads.
Well, so really, when the CLR initializes in a worker process, like you're saying, the thread pool will have no threads in it at all, initially.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The minimum, if you set the minimum number of threads, that's really a bad term that they used. It wasn't the most accurate word.
Oh, okay.
What minimum really is indicating is that the thread pool will add threads quickly up to that minimum.
Oh, okay.
Okay, mm-hmm. So minimum's just not the best word they should have chosen for that, because a lot of people have been confused by what that really means.
Okay.
And then the thread pool also has a maximum, so it will initially it'll have none. Then if you're queuing things up, it will go quickly to the minimum. So
right.
Minimum's not the right word. And then it will grow slowly up to the maximum, and mm-hmm. then it won't grow beyond the maximum.
Yeah.
But if an application is architected correctly, and by that I mean it's not blocking any of the threads, mm-hmm. then all of this should be meaningless to you.
Right.
By default, the minimum is set to the number of CPUs that are on the machine.
Mm-hmm.
So that really just means the thread pool will create number of threads equal to number of cores.
Mm.
And then it doesn't want to grow beyond that. And the only time it does, though, is if some of the threads in the pool are blocking and not running at all.
So if I've got, let's say I've got my apps poorly designed, it's doing a lot of synchronous calls, it's blocking.
Yeah.
The symptom I'm going to see is the thread count's going to start growing slowly over time
Right. Until
I hit the max. And then if there's still more load, then at some point the requests that are coming in off the wire are going to start backing up, and then I'm going to start the ASP.NET or whatever stack I'm using is going to start throwing errors like server busy or whatever. It's going to start timing out requests and things like that.
Sure. And your private bytes is going to increase too. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it kind of depends where the error occurs.
Yeah.
So the network device driver will accept a bunch of incoming requests into it. And then it will just kind of hold on to them. So the clients making the request, they're just not going to see any response for a while unless
mm-hmm.
your application starts accepting them. If your application is accepting them, then it's queuing them up into the thread pool.
Mm-hmm.
If it can't create any more threads in that process, like you hit the 1361 I showed earlier,
mm-hmm.
then the thread pool is going to throw an out-of-memory exception at a place where it's not your code. So it's actually impossible for you to catch that exception, and your entire service will terminate.
Mm.
And any clients that you're currently processing will just stop.
Yeah.
And then if you're being hosted with ASP.NET, then IIS will rerun you again for the next client, the request that comes in, but
mm-hmm.
you will have not responded to 1,360 some clients.
Right, right.
And they won't know what happened. They'll hit F5 in their browser to try to come back, and then you'll start running again until you hit that limit again.
Right. So if I'm... I guess the important thing to take away from here is when I'm writing code that's running server-side, first of all, any kind of work that I do, I think we could broadly divide it into CPU bound or I/O bound.
Oh yeah.
So talk about what's the distinction there? How do I know what kind of work I'm doing?
Well, if you're going to make a request off of the box, so normally a network request, and talking to a database, that's really a network request that's talking to the database, then you're I/O bound.
Yeah.
If you are talking to a file on the hard disk, then you are I/O bound. If you're a client-side app and you're playing audio, then you're I/O bound. So whenever a device driver would have to be involved, then you are I/O bound. For compute bound is when you're doing some kind of computation. So spell checking, grammar checking, compiling of code. If you have a collection, let's say an array of 10,000 items, and you want to scan through the array looking for the top 10 items that meet some criteria, then you are completely compute bound at that point. So you're not talking to some device driver on the machine.
Okay, so it probably, for most people, the kind of work that they generally do, it seems to me most people are writing I/O bound work.
Sure. Actually, I can prove that. If we just open up Task Manager on my machine and we look at the Performance tab, we can see that on my machine I have 80 processes running.
Yeah.
And my CPUs are 54%, and I have 2. So that means there's a process that's probably stuck in an infinite loop right now. And unfortunately, it's always Windows Live Mesh. So maybe you want to edit that out. I don't know. But if we kill that.
Yeah.
All right, so now you can see that of the 80 processes on my machine now, my CPU is busy, but it was about 6% of the time. Something's happening right now. I think it's restarting, actually.
Yeah, probably.
It doesn't want to go away.
Yeah.
But normally the CPU usage on most machines is maybe 2 or 3% of the time.
Right. Right.
Which means that all of these processes are not using the CPU for anything.
They're just waiting on stuff.
Yeah, so there's I.O. They're waiting for me to type on the keyboard. They're waiting for me to move the mouse. They're waiting for network requests to come in to serve up files, maybe.
Right.
Right? And so most applications are I.O. bound.
Now, in our last episode, we talked about the difference between the I.O. thread pool and the worker thread pool. Because now, let's say that I did have some CPU-bound work. Like, I got this huge array of stuff I'm going to have to search or something like that. So if I'm doing CPU bound work, it's probably a good idea to just do it, right? I mean, just do it. But if I'm on an I/O thread,
unless you can break it into chunks, then you can have multiple threads participating to try to get the whole thing done in less time.
Okay, maybe like if I use
where tasks, .NET for tasks come in really useful.
Yeah,
that's
or the parallel link stuff, and
yes,
maybe
exactly.
I could use that to break it up. Yeah, okay.
Right.
Yeah, because in a source, of course, when I do this, I'm making a little trade-off that breaking up these against a bunch of threads is a better idea than just making this one thread run it a little more slowly so I can allow more threads to come in. I guess that's part of the trade-off that I'm making there.
Yes.
Okay, so yeah, I mean, if I wanted to do that, I could get off the I/O thread by dispatching the work to a task and get the callback from the task.
So the artifact that there are I/O threads and worker threads, I mean, in an ideal world, the distinction wouldn't exist,
right?
Actually. And in fact, in Windows Vista, Microsoft introduced some new thread pooling APIs as part of the operating system, and they got rid of that distinction. In the thread pool that shipped in Windows 2000, there were these worker threads and I/O threads.
Oh, okay.
And really, the CLR team stole that implementation out of Windows 2000 and built it into the CLR, so they kept it. But in Windows Vista, the Windows team got rid of that distinction, and there's just a thread pool with threads that are coming out of it.
Okay.
And so we would love to see in the CLR that distinction also go away ultimately over time. But the worker threads are used today in the CLR for computation. So when you call queues or work bound, a queues or work item, or when you new up a task and you call start, it is those worker threads that are doing that work.
Okay.
And then when a device driver responds with a result of an I/O, it gets posted to the I/O thread pool.
I see. Okay.
It's really an implementation detail that
right.
hopefully will go away.
Yeah, okay. But so whatever kind of server-side stack I'm using, whether it's MVC or Windows Workflow or WCF, almost all these stacks provide some kind of way to do my thing asynchronously.
Yes.
And so, you know, it's probably a very good idea for me to learn however that is. Like MVC has an async controller. WCF has an async pattern. I mean, I should probably take advantage of those wherever possible, right?
Oh, I mean, the whole reason why they're there is those async patterns is so you can avoid blocking threads so you can build scalable software.
Yeah.
So certainly the idea would be to understand that and to try to take advantage of it. If you're trying to build scalable software for a server or for a client-side app, we would say a responsive app where the GUI never freezes because of some I/O that's taking a long period of time.
Yeah. In fact, so I wish we had time to talk about them. We're actually out of time. But, I mean, we've done, there's this whole cool async CTP thing that's out there. That's a lot, that's coming. Beautiful stuff. I mean, and we're actually doing a lot of work in the next release of .NET to make it much easier to do async things when you're consuming services with WCF.
Right.
So there's beautiful things going on there as well.
Yeah, the great thing, I'll just say this because I know you're out of time. The great thing about the async stuff is that that's coming in the next version is it really unifies the programming model.
Right.
So the begin and end is, was effectively deprecated by this new async stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the event-based APM for web client and those classes, the background worker, is effectively deprecated.
Yeah.
And so it's not just that we can do a lot more things asynchronously, but we have a consistent, coherent programming model that people can work to that integrates all of this together, compute-bound and I/O-bound in a very nice way.
Beautiful. Well, thanks so much, Jeff, for joining us
today. My pleasure.
And we'll see you next time on AppFabric TV.